Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Deity, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
Yes, I am a sound scientist. Came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
Hey, this is Jess.
And this is Todd. Welcome to The Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
Humanism is the worldview of being good without the belief in God or the supernatural.
Exactly. So what's up, Jess? You just moved.
I did, Todd. I just moved from Albany to Providence, Rhode Island. I'm very excited. So I guess now I'm an official New Englander, right?
That's true, I guess. It's upstate New York, sort of New England. I mean, technically, but
it depends. Like, I used to classify it as such, but I've gotten several looks from true New Englanders, like just looks of disgust. Like, no, it's not.
Yeah, it's so I know you're in the area for just a couple of days. Are you going to check out any of the humanist and atheist groups once you get settled in a little bit?
Yeah, I definitely plan on doing that. You know, I already got to meet Steve Alquist, who's the head of the Rhode Island Humanists. And so what I understand is that it's more of a social meetup type situation. But, you know, I'll see what I can do. I'm excited.
Well, it is. I don't know the details of the organization, but I do know they do a little bit of charity and altruistic type works as well. They actually have a team that Steve leads for the Foundation Beyond Belief Leukemia and Lymphoma Society.
Oh, nice.
Project we're doing, the Light the Night Walks, which is pretty cool. You could always join that if you'd like.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
AHA is an official ally of the project, so it would fit right in.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, Jessica.
Jessica's on the team.
No, I mean me, Jessica.
Oh, the other Jessica. I'm sorry.
Listen.
You're the second most famous humanist. I just wanted to make that clear.
Thanks. As if I needed that.
Although I don't even think of you as a Jessica. You're just Jess.
That's fair. We'll have a little showdown of the Jessicas.
But I guess unintentional segue, but for all the listeners, yeah, we are gearing up for the project. So the walks are starting in just a couple weeks. So if you haven't joined a team, please do so. We're trying to hit $1 million. We have over 120 teams now, which is kind of crazy, all across the US and Canada. And but we have a lot of money to raise. We just shifted to fundraising mode like a few days ago. So we're shifting from recruiting teams and people to raising money. Of course, we still welcome new people, like the second best Jess.
Second best? I thought I was the second popular.
Oh,
jeez.
Sorry. Hyperbole escapes me, or escapes from me, I guess. You could go to pages.lightthenight.org/2012/FBB, the second longest URL in Rhode Island. Sign up for one of the teams or donate or whatever and help the AHA and help the whole movement out and help help fight cancer, most importantly.
So, Todd, what's new? What's happening in the movement?
Well, there's one thing that's kind of more statistical in nature, but was I found really exciting. And there's actually another thing more new on the fundamentals front, but both actually great pieces of news for our side. I love that. So
yeah,
one is there was just a new survey done, a global survey done by Gallup and some partners, and the last time they did the survey was 2005, and in that survey, they asked people's religious beliefs, and it was basically along the lines of, are you religious, are you not religious, or are you a convinced atheist? And I'm paraphrasing, but you know, it would take a lot to say, like, I'm not just not religious, I'm a convinced atheist. So in back 2005, it was only 1% that identified as an atheist. That jumped to 5%, so a 5x increase in just 7.
Wow,
it's huge.
Yeah,
huge. And I mean, I'm sure that would include, I'm sure, a lot of people who would also consider themselves humanists and agnostic. You know, maybe some agnostics even.
Right.
Those who don't know, you know, those who are both agnostics and atheists. But yeah, pretty cool to see such a huge jump. And what was also interesting was just the number of people that claim to be non-religious just in general was huge, much larger than a lot of other surveys. So much so, actually, that Barry Cosman, the guy responsible for the American Religious Identification Survey, the one that was famous for the 15% nuns figure, has kind of questioned, like, maybe Gallup screwed parts of this up. There's no real evidence for that, but it's like the numbers are so staggering, you almost have to question it. It wasn't 15% nuns. It was 35% plus the 5% atheists. So
really?
Now in the nuns, that also includes included in that 35%, 5% of the figure was people who said, like, don't know, don't answer, etc. But you got to assume a whole lot of those are probably agnostics or people who just don't give a crap. And if you don't give a crap, you're probably not religious. So yeah, kind of crazy. It was 60% identified as religious, self-identified. That's it. That's a lot of people, but that's not a strong, that's not an overwhelming majority here.
Certainly isn't. And that's just, that's religious as a whole. That's not breaking down individual religions, which are totally different.
Exactly. So if 40% of the country just doesn't give a hoot or is atheist or is non-religious, that's a pretty massive segment. Like, for example, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, 1% of the country is Jewish, 12.6% African-American, 16.3% Hispanic. That's 29.9% combined. That's less than 30.
Right.
So Jews, African-Americans, and Hispanics, a smaller section of the population than, you know, people who don't check the box as religious. So what if we could get, and what is going to happen when we do get, because I think it's just a matter of time, especially how quickly our demographics are growing. Can you imagine how different this country is going to be when the politicians pay as much attention to that 40% as they do to each of those pieces of the 30%?
Yeah. And that's kind of fitting to our today's guest, Todd.
Yeah, Dave Niosi's got a new book out, Nonbeliever Nation, The Rise of Secular Americans, which focuses a lot on the movement as a whole and hits on all sorts of aspects of it. And
he's also an attorney. He's an activist. And of course, he's the president of the American Humanist Association.
He's made an enormous number of national appearances on behalf of the HA and even humanism in general, from Fox News, the BBC, to the Alan Colmes Show. And he writes regularly online for Psychology Today.
And I certainly think that Dave Niosi, he's a great spokesperson for our movement, and I'm certainly proud to have him as a spokesperson for the organization that I work for, just because I think that he approaches issues with just this beautiful balance of data, of science, of like just this knowledge, but matched with this like appealing to emotion and humility. And I think it's great. Like, I think he is someone who can translate the things that we talk about, the issues that concern us, with, you know, just about anyone. Like, he could talk in any environment, and I feel like he could win any crowd over. So listeners, here he is, Dave Niosi.
Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So Dave Niosi, thanks so much for being on our show. Many of our listeners have probably at least heard of you if they haven't, in fact, met you or seen you speak at a conference or at their local group, because you are the president of the American Humanist Association, but you're also an activist and a lawyer, and of course, you're an author. So why don't we start our show? Just tell us a little bit about your book, Nonbeliever Nation, The Rise of Secular Americans.
Sure. It's a book about the culture wars, basically. Of course, any book about the culture wars is about the religious right, and I try to get into some of the history, how the religious right came to power. Most people date it back to around 1979, when Jerry Falwell formed the Moral Majority, and I kind of run through that. Very importantly, though, I also try to spend quite a bit of time talking about the opposition to the religious right. We always hear about the religious right, but we don't hear so much about the opposition to it. And, you know, I talk about basically why the opposition has failed, because I think no matter what side you're on in the culture wars, you have to look back at the last 30 years and conclude that the religious right has been quite successful in pursuing its agenda. It's got more and more powerful as time has gone on. And that means basically that the opposition has failed. So why has it failed? And I go into that quite a bit. And then I conclude by saying that the modern secular movement, which is really in its infancy, I would say the last 7 or 8 years it's taken shape, the modern secular movement represents a new kind of opposition to the religious right that offers hope that maybe we can return the religious right to what I call pre-Reagan levels of potency. It is a movement-oriented book, I would say that much. There's a lot of books out there talking about how religion is outdated and, you know, belief in God is, you know, a thing of the past or should be, that sort of thing. This book is not really a theological book, you know, talking about the atheism so much. I mean, of course, I go into that, but it's really about the movement. It's about why secularity needs to be recognized and respected in America, and why the secular demographic has to emerge just so that we can get public policy into a more rational place.
So can you, talking about the secular demographic, can you give us some context here? Like what is the size of it and how does that compare to other demographics that are important as far as politics go and things like that?
Sure. There's several ways of looking at it, and it really depends whether you want to look at religious belief, religious identity, or religious practice, because each one of those categories sizes up a lot differently than the other does. The number that I like to use is 15 to 20% of the population. I think that's a fairly moderate assessment of what I would call the secular demographic. I think an argument could be made that it's larger, arguments could be made that it's smaller. But if you look at the American Religious Identification Survey, it shows that 81% of the American population actually affirms a God belief. That would be 69% saying that they believe in a personal God and 12% saying that they believe in a higher power, whatever that is. That would leave about 19% who do not affirm a belief in a God. So, you know, that's right in the middle of that 15 to 20% range that I suggest. We all also know that about 18 or 19% of Americans now identify as not affiliated with any religion. Now, there are arguments that some of those people might be believers, and I think that's probably true. But I think also some who do identify with religion are probably non-believers. So they probably offset each other. And once again, we're in a number in the upper teens that would fall into secular. But if you look at the issue of religious practice, it's very interesting because only about half the American population actually attends any religious service on a regular basis. So in the realm of religious practice, you arguably have half the population that's pretty secular.
Right. So where do you think then the fear comes from if it's people, or I guess, I don't know, maybe I'm saying that early, but I see that there's a lot of fear of people who don't believe in God. And if, you know, you're not practicing it yourself, so how good of, you know, someone in your religion are you? But yet you're fearful of me just because I don't, not only do I not practice religion, but I don't believe in it either.
Well, you know, I think the whole idea of demonizing secularity is a very interesting phenomenon, and it needs to be broken down a little bit because there is this paradigm in American public discussion that atheists are feared and all that. If you really think about it, though, it's not so much the case. There's actually a lot of appreciation of secularity in American life. If you think of the popularity of George Carlin and Bill Maher, if you see any stand-up comedian, there's a very good chance you'll see jokes that take jabs at organized religion, and people love it. Think of the epic status of the Monty Python movies, right? It's not like there's just a fringe element in society that likes that kind of stuff. Everyone likes it. So I think we need to recognize that there's a very unusual phenomenon in that once we cross into the realm of politics, all of a sudden, all the rhetoric becomes very pious, and there's a lot of talk about how America is a very religious country and all that. Once you leave the realm of politics, however, there's a great appreciation of religious skepticism, critical thinking, and irreverence. So I think as a demographic, we need to focus some attention on the positive side of how in most of society, there's an appreciation of where we're coming from. And question why, when we step into the realm of politics, all of a sudden religious skepticism becomes taboo. If we do that, maybe we can bring some of that appreciation of skepticism into politics as well, and that would really change things.
Now, I appreciate the positive outlook because it's a very good point, and we often focus on the challenges we face as a movement rather than on some of the ways we've made enormous progress. I guess one place I'd like to challenge you is beyond politics. One place I've seen a big difference is in terms of values, whereas a lot of people might appreciate a George Carlin or other famous comedians or entertainers, Brad Pitt, for example. When it comes to stereotyping, there is an often assumption that somebody who is atheistic or secular humanistic are lacking in values because they don't have that inherent carrot and stick of heaven and hell. And I've heard that from just many, many everyday Joes that are religious who just have this built-in assumption like, oh my gosh, well, how can you be ethical, or how can you teach your children to be ethical people without church? And so I'm curious as to what your opinion is there, if there is a level of discrimination that you found in your research or have seen regarding the issue of our values and our ability to be ethical.
Well, I think there's some of that. I also think it's something that doesn't really play out in real life. And in other words, if you ask people about it, they will often jump to the conclusion that religion and morality are synonymous. But as they live their daily lives, it's not like they really construct their values around their religious identity so much. I think it's kind of a way of thinking that people will gravitate to if pressed by the question, you know, where do values come from? Well, they really haven't given it a whole lot of thought. So as they answer the question, they just jump to the religion paradigm. But I do think it's an area where the secular movement needs to do more work in educating and informing people about the fact that religion and morality are not synonymous. It's simply a subject that most people don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about and analyzing. So when they are asked about it, they give the knee-jerk response. But if you ask most people to really analyze it, they will very quickly realize that hypocrisy and religion are often synonymous. Morality and religion may be synonymous at one level in their minds, but hypocrisy and religion are also synonymous at a level in their minds as well. And we need to call attention to that and just call attention to the fact that, people are people, and you're going to see good and bad in people, whether they happen to walk around with a religious identity on their sleeve or not.
So it sounds like a lot of that work can happen just with conversations with people, like in your neighborhoods and your, you know, as you travel, just talking to people instead of, like, it doesn't have to be in a book somewhere. It can just be like, well, this is, you know, what I believe, and this is how I raise my children, and how do you do it, and is it really from religion?
That's absolutely right. I think you hit the nail on the head. The real thing that has to happen is that this communication has to be happening, and it can't happen if people are in the closet about their own secularity. And that's why one of the important points that I put forward in Nonbeliever Nation is that we need an identity-oriented movement happening here, and it is happening. It's certainly already off the ground. It's just a matter of how high it can soar. We need an identity-oriented movement where people are talking about their personal secularity openly. It's not like we need to be out proselytizing on behalf of secularism, but we do need to be open about who we are and what we're about. If everyone is in the closet about their secularity, then by definition, nobody is really talking about the fact that morality and religion are not synonymous. But if people are walking around and identifying openly on Facebook and elsewhere as atheist, agnostic, or humanist, whatever secular identity you prefer, then it's out there. It's a topic that can be brought up and discussed. And the more communication that's happening, either on an interpersonal level between secular people and religious people, or on an organizational level by secular groups communicating on a mass communication level about how secular beliefs and a secular worldview is just as moral as a religious one, then we're changing minds. We're changing attitudes.
Right.
You mentioned earlier that you trace the religious right movement back to primarily the founding of the Moral Majority in 1979. Something I've always wondered is how much of this significant push towards organizing the right started with Roe versus Wade. So I was wondering, when you did your research, if you saw any kind of precursors that kind of built up to this Moral Majority point, or, you know, that period from Roe v. Wade in 1973 to 1979, what was happening then?
There was a lot happening. Most people date the religious right, the modern religious right, to the Moral Majority, but there is an issue as to exactly, well, what caused the Moral Majority, you know, and a lot of people will point to Roe versus Wade. And I do think the abortion issue helped mobilize religious fundamentalists. There are other things going on, though. Of course, Billy Graham was very popular even before the Moral Majority. He advised presidents and he was a very high profile preacher. He is on TV with his crusades and whatnot. One thing that a lot of people point to that is not as well known as the abortion issue in Roe versus Wade is the controversy over Bob Jones University back in the 1970s. There was some talk about the university possibly losing its tax-exempt status because it refused to allow interracial dating on campus and things like that. So there are a lot of issues kind of under the surface in the fundamentalist right back in the 1970s that caused a lot of the leaders of the Christian right to begin talking and organizing and thinking about how they could fight back. I think on the fundamentalist right, there was a kind of a siege mentality, especially in the 60s and 70s, where there was a lot of forward-moving liberalism. There was a sense that they were under siege, and the natural reaction to that is to circle the wagons and start thinking strategically about how to fight back. And the result of that was the religious right.
How did they connect emotionally with people? How did they get and maybe that's not even what they did, but help educate us on how they did become so powerful and so popular, because I mean, we're in a similar situation in many ways, except it's been going on for millennia. We have our rights sometimes challenged or attacked rhetorically, and it's often left out of the public debate. And, you know, now that the religious right is so powerful, what lessons can we take from how they became popularized to popularize secularism?
Well, I don't really like to draw a line between what the religious right did and what we should do, because except for the end result, which was success, I don't think the approach of the religious right is really something we'd want to model. I think the religious right is mainly constructed on a foundation of fear. I think the common thread that you'll see throughout the religious right is a true fear of modernity. I think, and this has been written about widely, the concept of fundamentalism around the world, not just Christian fundamentalism, but even Islamic fundamentalism, and in Judaism, there's a fundamentalist streak as well. And what you see with fundamentalists is a fear of modernity. There's just this sense that the world is changing so rapidly and it's not understood, so we need to revert back to traditional religion and biblical views of things. And that's not something the secular movement would want to model. I mean, I think there is something to be said for fear as a motivator, and we do have a lot to fear if the secular movement is not successful. So maybe on that level, we should realize that we should point out the potential downside of failure, and that might help motivate our demographic into action.
I guess I can understand using fear as a motivator when it's based in science. Like, yes, we need to live with producing less of an impact on the planet because, you know, global warming is real and something is going to happen. But, you know, outside of that, like, I agree with you, Dave. I don't think it's something that we want to reproduce at all.
Right. You know, obviously they've been successful not by the power of their ideas, right? I mean, the ideas of the Christian right have been out of date for almost a century. One thing I point out in the book is that if you go back to the presidential election of 1912, you see candidates who seem to be more enlightened than many of the candidates today. Woodrow Wilson, who won the 1912 election, is on record as stating, "Of course I accept the theory of evolution. At this late date, who wouldn't?" So, I mean, and that was 100 years ago. So the religious right has succeeded not by winning a debate with the secular demographic. They've succeeded by successfully excluding the secular demographic from the debate. And that's really one of the main things that Nonbeliever Nation is about, is that we've lost, the secular demographic has been marginalized and excluded from the public debate. We don't have a place at the table. We're excluded from politics. Up on Capitol Hill, there's 535 congressmen and senators, only one open atheist. That's not the way that America should be in the second decade of the 21st century. The religious right has won so far by excluding us, not by beating us on substantive debate.
So do you think, as far as, you know, in our government goes, that it's not that there aren't people there who are non-believers, but it's that they're just not out about it? Or do you think that they don't exist as much as we want or need?
You mean sitting in office now?
Yeah.
I think there are legislators who are, in fact, personally secular. In fact, we know that, but they're not willing to come out about it. But I think what we need is more of them, first of all, but we also need them to be visible. The debate cannot be fully rational if there's a sense that the secular worldview is unacceptable in the political realm. That this exaltation of religion and religiosity is really holding back American public policy.
I think something that's extremely encouraging from what you're saying about the religious right being built on a fear of modernity is that modernity is real. And over time, if their foundation is a denial of the modern world and real advances, time will continuously prove them wrong. And hopefully in the long term, it will outdate itself and their foundation will just continuously collapse. Do you think that will happen?
Well, I'm hesitant to make predictions about the future because when I have in the past, I've often been wrong. So it's somewhat speculation. But I can say this, that if the secular movement is not successful, I shudder to think what the country and what the world will look like in, you know, 50 years, 60 years. We can't continue on the trajectory that we have been traveling on so far. The last 30 years have really been a disaster for public policy. We've seen a complete loss of substantive discussion, really. I mean, even just look at the news today and look at how the presidential campaign is discussed. That they harp on one or two sound bites that really have no substantive meaning at all. Biden said something recently about something about being unchained, and all the media wants to talk about is whether this was an appropriate comment or not. It has nothing to do with any substantive issue, and that's what you see time and again in political discourse in this country. And we just can't continue with education, environment, social policy, all under attack from extreme social conservatives. So we need to have a more rational debate. And it's not going to happen until there's a secular emergence.
Dave, you've done a ton of interviews and you've been on book tours. And like, what is something about your book that hasn't been asked about that you'd love to discuss?
The one aspect of the book that really hasn't been discussed or at least asked about is the movement orientation of the book. A lot of interviewers who are unfamiliar with the book, who perhaps haven't even read it, seem to think it must be a religion-bashing book. You know, oh, non-believer nation, this guy's taking the gloves off and beating up religion. Not the case at all. What the book really talks about is the need for a secular emergence, how this is the second decade of the 21st century, and we still have in much of the country a sense that a candidate who believes the world is less than 10,000 years old is a viable candidate with good public policy positions, whereas somebody who is not theistic, who approaches the world from a completely naturalistic standpoint, is unfit for office. We're not saying that religion needs to be done away with and that everyone has to become secular. In fact, we're not really looking for converts at all. Of course, we'd welcome them. But what we're really looking for as a movement is a place at the table, that we're trying to point out to religious and non-religious Americans that a secular demographic is a valuable demographic, that it shouldn't be excluded from public policy. And it's that movement orientation that I really like to emphasize.
So, Dave, another area that we've seen this sort of idea of having an identity-based movement is with the LGBT movement. And I've read one of your columns on Psychology Today on how people compare this process of choosing and coming out, you know, in being gay and saying that that's not a choice, but choosing and coming out and being religious or non-religious is a choice. And you have a different opinion on that. Can you share that with our listeners?
Well, it often is said that, you know, if you're secular, you've decided to not believe in God, and therefore, you know, it's a decision you make. In other words, your religious identity is something you choose, but that may be true to a point. I mean, obviously, if I decide to identify as atheist, that's a decision I've made. But ultimately, the underlying belief is not something that we can choose. We can try to believe, and we can try to be a good Catholic. But ultimately, whether you believe in God or whether you believe in any sort of supernatural concept is not something you decide. It's an end product of your environment and your genetic makeup, right? We have a cultural upbringing, and to some degree, we're going to attach ourselves to that, even as our actual beliefs may vary from it. And I think a lot of people do that. I mean, I was raised Catholic in a fairly Catholic area. I'm from New England, so there's a lot of Catholics in the Boston area. And I can't tell you how many conversations I've had over the years with people who will identify as Catholic, but they'll say candidly that they doubt even the divinity of Jesus. So, you know, figure that out. Are they really Catholic? I mean, I think the church would question, you know, whether they are true Catholics or not. But, you know, again, it's the whole area of religious identity versus religious belief and versus religious practice. They sometimes go in three completely separate directions. So that's something worth pondering, because I think this sense that atheists choose to be atheists, therefore we should, just let them live with the consequences of their decision, so to speak, is really kind of a messed up view of reality. The reality is that there are more and more non-believers because as humanity has marched forward, more and more knowledge has come into being that allows us to not believe, and that results in us not believing. So I think that's something to keep in mind as we analyze the subject of religion and secularity.
I guess the choice for me comes in with how do you act? How do you live? Like, maybe you don't have the choice in what you are, but you have the choice to live that way. And maybe the same can be said for living, secularly.
Right. And I think a lot of people don't identify as secular because they have a sense that it's not really acceptable. When we live in a society, we always try to get a sense of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. Where can you push the envelope and where do you not want to push the envelope? And I think in modern American society, there's definitely a sense that you need not actually be very religious. That's not a prerequisite to living in our society. You can be pretty secular. You cannot attend church. You cannot pray. And you can basically be pretty secular, and that's okay. But you cannot openly identify as atheists and really press that issue because that's a little bit crossing the line. And I don't know exactly why that's the case. I think, atheism historically has often been demonized. And I think, in the 20th century, there was an association between our communist enemy, the Soviet Union, and atheism. So there was that going on. But obviously, the sense that it's okay to be secular, but it's not okay to be too openly and assertively secular, that's the battleground right now for the secular movement. I mean, we've got secularity basically accepted, but the idea of being openly secular, especially openly atheist, is not accepted, especially in the realm of politics. So that's where the battleground is right now. And I'll tell you, I think we're making progress. When I talk to younger people, all you see is this kind of they're baffled at why the older generation has such a hang up about atheism. I was talking to one young woman recently about the connection between communism and atheism, and her reaction was, she said, "Oh, that's so 20th century." And that's exactly, as a movement, what we like to see: younger people who don't have that hang up about atheism.
Right. And I feel like the same thing probably happened with race and with sexuality. Like, it's the next generation is always been like, well, I don't understand what the big deal is.
Exactly. And I think to the extent that that's happening in our movement, that's a great thing.
Of course, this is the official podcast of the American Humanist Association, and you're the president of AHA. What role would you like to see AHA play in this non-believer nation going forward?
Humanism is obviously a lot different than atheism, and the AHA's role in the movement is to promote humanism. Humanism is an entire worldview, whereas atheism is just a view on one singular issue, whether God or gods exist or not. And obviously an atheist says, no, they do not exist. But an atheist, theoretically anyway, could still believe in astrology, could still believe in fairies, could still believe in the Loch Ness Monster and all these things. An atheist is not by definition someone who approaches the world from a natural standpoint. So humanism is the entire package. Not only do you view the issue of divinities naturalistically, but you view all issues naturalistically. You approach the world from a scientific, naturalistic worldview, which means, of course, a humanist would not accept astrology or belief in fairies and whatnot. So humanism is an entire set of ethical principles. A humanist stands for human rights, for women's rights, and all these things. So the role of the AHA and the movement is to promote not just disbelief in gods and respect for people who don't believe in gods, but the entire humanistic worldview and the values and principles that go along with the humanist worldview. And frankly, that's why I prefer to identify as a humanist. I will identify as an atheist because I think it's important that the atheist identity be rehabilitated in American society, that we stop demonizing atheists. But to me, on a personal level, it's more important that I identify as a humanist because that's my entire worldview, not just my view on deities.
What can individual listeners do to become more active and make a difference? What are kind of some quick things they can do to help us get a voice at the table?
Well, first and foremost is the importance of identifying openly. And obviously, everyone has to decide on a personal level what their comfort zone is as far as identification goes. I mean, if you are 16 years old and you live under the roof of mom and dad are diehard fundamentalist Christians who are going to kick you out of the house and ostracize you if you identify openly, then obviously I'm not asking you to identify so openly. But to the extent you can, to the extent that open secular identity is something that you can do, then push your comfort zone and do it. Let your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers know that they are interacting on a daily basis with somebody who does not believe in gods, with somebody who identifies either as an atheist or an agnostic or a humanist. This sort of identity-oriented approach to activism is very important. It's really what made the LGBT movement so successful over the last 20 or 30 years, is this idea of coming out, of letting people know that it's normal, that it's something that is all over the place in American society, this idea of secular identity and a secular worldview. There's nothing we can do that is more effective than that. Beyond that now, I would say join and become active in secular and humanist groups, both at the local level. You know, find a local AHA chapter or even a meetup in your area of atheists and humanists, and start interacting with the local community of people like yourself. And also join, of course, at the national level. Support the national groups that are leading the charge in this movement. All of these things will help help change American society for the better.
Those all sound like really tangible take-home ideas that everyone can do, and that makes me hopeful. So thank you for that perspective, and thanks for that advice, Dave.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, one thing I'd point out just to add to that is, you know, the religious right has been very successful over the last 30 years. There's no denying that. But one thing we should realize is that there's one area where they truly have failed. And that area is the LGBT area, right? Despite the enormous success of the religious right, the LGBT movement has made unthinkable strides over the last 30 years. I mean, if you're old enough to remember 30 years ago, you never would have imagined that, you know, within a few decades, gays and lesbians would be able to get married in America. Look at the enormous success of the LGBT movement. And how did they do it despite the power of the religious right? They did it through identity-oriented activism, right? So that's why we need to do it too.
Awesome. Well, thanks for all of the awesome ideas, and thanks for creating a great book for our listeners. The book is Nonbeliever Nation, The Rise of Secular Americans. Dave Niosi, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That was Dave Niosi, president of the American Humanist Association.
You can purchase Dave's book at Amazon.com. You'll find a link to that on the show notes page for this episode. Also on that page, you'll find a link to Dave's book tour. He's got some tour dates going through the fall, so definitely check that out. And if you want to read more about Dave's columns in Psychology Today, you can do that at psychologytoday.com. We also syndicate them in our weekly newsletter, the Humanist Network News, so you can subscribe to that. And also definitely follow Dave on Twitter and Facebook because he'll keep you up to date on what's happening in the movement.
Now what? Our movement is definitely growing, and certainly the percentages of the population that are either part of our movement or would lean towards our movement if they were more actively engaged in these type of issues are growing dramatically. It's very, very, very encouraging. And the more these demographics switch, the more, frankly, I think all of our enemy might be strong of a word, but I kind of see them that way. The religious right, or the religious wrong, if you will, the more their power drops. So
I'm just looking on psychologytoday.com. And so Dave wrote toward the end of June that atheist acceptability is on the rise in America. So we've now sort of tipped over to 54% as far as who would you vote for a secular candidate in an election.
Yeah, it's a dramatic shift, although we have a long way to go because African-American, female, Catholic, all sorts of categories that used to be somewhat taboo in politics and used to be down in like that 40, 50% range once upon a time, some of them at least, are all over like 95%. Just about anybody would vote for a woman or an African-American without even thinking about it. So for us to be at 54%, while is a huge jump, we went from 45% to 54% just since the last time this was done. And that's awesome to have that kind of jump in like 5-6 years, but we got a long, long way to go. We need that number up over 90%, just like everyone else. I actually consider right. that stat to be the most indicative statistic we have of discrimination.
Sure. I mean, and we're definitely at the bottom of the list. Like, it's Muslims are at 58%, gays and lesbians are at 68%, and Mormons are at 80%. And so that's all, you know, they all rank higher than atheists. And I guess I should clarify it's 54% of Americans would not consider a candidate's atheism to be a disqualification for holding the nation's
right.
highest, you know. So it's not necessarily they'd vote for them, but it's that they wouldn't
right.
see it as a disqualifying characteristic.
I think the question they ask is something along the lines of, if there was a well-qualified candidate from within your own political party running
right.
for office that was a blank, would you vote, you know, would you vote for them? And so they're basically saying, this is a qualified candidate. You like them. They're your kind of person, but they're black.
That's right.
Most people are like, well, duh, yeah, of course.
Right. You know, but they wouldn't always have said that. So,
which is today. But if you look back 50 years, a huge percentage would have said no, because there was a lot of bigots.
Right. And it's almost like you wouldn't even have asked that about atheism. Like, you wouldn't even have dared to ask.
Right. And now African Americans have come a long way. The LGBT community has come a long way in that study over time. And we've come a long way too, but we've got a long way to go, as do several other groups. But, you know, I mean, you just think about the way the question's asked. If you say, you know, hey, you've got a qualified candidate from your party. But they're an Eskimo. Oh, forget it. They're out of consideration. Okay, you obviously have something against Eskimos. So, you know,
right.
we still have, not to look at the negative side, but we still have, you know, almost half the population that would vote against us just because of our humanism or atheism. I think that needs to change. But it's so nice to see dramatic, quick progress on some of these things. And that's very, very encouraging and really shows we're having a pretty direct impact. And that's
right.
that's pretty sweet.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, Dave, as he mentioned in our interview, it's getting to be less of an issue with the younger population. So that's just hopeful for the future.
Exactly. I actually just pulled up the stats, and from 2007 to 2012, the number who would not eliminate us for our atheism, so who would likely vote for us, went from 45% to 54%. That's huge. That's huge. That's like a tenth, almost a tenth of the population switched positions on this in a 7-year period. And in this, in the same period of time, the number of us out there who are willing to identify in one of these surveys as atheistic, you know, went up 5x. So it's huge. Very, very encouraging. So, so here's another fun piece of news for us, at least, or I guess it's bad news for the other side, but many of our listeners may be familiar with David Barton, who I wasn't that familiar with until a couple of years ago. But
I'm not familiar.
He is one of the key revisionist historians in the country and extremely popular with the kind of radical religious right, popular with a lot of hard right people in Congress, very well tied into the Republican Party. I believe he was the vice chairman of the Republican Party of Texas for quite a while and was very influential in the rewriting of some of their policies on textbooks. So was one of the ones that helped push Texas to shift some of the things and kind of restyle history. He clearly states that in his opinion, this is not a country with church state separation. It was never intended. He's one of these big Christian nation proponents. And, apparently Congress people call him regularly to get quotes about the founding fathers and what they would have said on issues like stimulus plans. And, you know, he gives a set of his books to everyone in Congress. And of course, there are some of the more, conservative ones of either party, put them up on, you know, put them on prominent display, et cetera. This guy is extremely powerful. So he's a Christian educator. He's not a historian by training. And he writes these books to kind of push his worldview, which he's been very successful at. I mean, heck, where he's most influential, which is Texas. This is a quote, apparently, from the Republican GOP platform of Texas, which is, "We pledge our influence towards a return to the original intent of the First Amendment and towards dispelling the myth of separation of church and state." Page 14. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But here's the new fun twist. NPR and a couple other things did big profiles on him recently in his books. And there's also been some very conservative historians that have started turning against this guy for like just falsifying things and making stuff up and lying, essentially. And they have some of the like ultra conservatives have been starting to call for boycotts, like turning against this guy, of not just him, but of like the publisher of his books for being so radical.
Wow.
Yeah. So the publisher looked into some of these claims, even though the publisher helped edit the book and all this stuff. So they're not totally off the hook, but they eventually made their call. They looked into these claims and found that what these other historians were saying was true. He was making claims that were completely, utterly unfounded. So the publisher pulled the book, stopped publishing it, cut it. And now it's become this other news story that now his book has been pulled. And this is a Christian book publisher. It's not like some unbiased source. They're biased theoretically in his favor, and yet they yanked the book, and he has been like horribly shamed publicly and hopefully pulled off his pedestal. I'm sure he will rise again, but his ability to influence the mainstream has been significantly damaged. I'm sure the evangelicals who want to believe that Jefferson was a ultra conservative Christian will still find a way to convince themselves.
Yeah.
But
and it's like, it's also hopeful that there's a little bit of reason on the right.
Yeah, it is nice to see a little bit of reason in there, a little bit of critical thinking. And when one of their own goes too far,
right,
they push back, which is very nice to see. Yeah, and you know, frankly, it's not, you know, I want to be fair here. The Republicans certainly are, you know, seem to have more people like David Barton barking things, but there's a whole army of Democrats on board with this as well. So, you know, this is a bipartisan issue that the whole country really needs to address. And the good news is there is pushing back happening even from the conservative side of things, and our numbers are growing. What we need is that 40% out there to stand up and fight back. And they may be apathetic on the issue of religion, but we can't be apathetic on the issues of how religion plays out in our government and our day-to-day lives.
Right.
So we need everybody out there listening, you know, to step back and think to themselves, do I want my government making decisions as if it's a theocracy? And there's certainly a lot of people out there of both parties making decisions every day exactly based on that, whether right. it's because they believe it or because they're afraid of the power of the religious right. We need to change that. And the good news is the demographics are switching extremely quickly, and we're starting to see a lot of victories. So, yay.
I wonder how that will, the change or the shift in the demographics, or at least in the identification, which is reflected in these demographic polls. I wonder how that will be reflected in like the upcoming election, for example.
It'll be interesting to see.
The more local elections and the smaller scale, I think those are just as important, if not more important. For representative of the demographics. Like that's where change occurs, you know, and then it trickles up, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what they did. They started at school boards and worked their way up.
Right. So I think that, you know, you were talking about what can we learn from the religious right. I think that is a strategy that we should subscribe to.
Indeed. Awesome.
Well, Todd, thanks for another great month.
To you as well. What do we have coming up next month?
I believe next month we've got Gloria Steinem.
Yeah, our team got an awesome interview with her, and we've got some cool footage from her speech. So,
yeah, I mean, speaking, you know, just all around rock star. I mean, that's what I think her official title should be. Yeah. You know, activist, feminist, writer. I mean, she's just
editor, publisher.
Yep.
I believe pretty much all of those things. Yeah.
Yeah, so definitely tune in next month. And in the meantime, be sure to check out our website, thehumanisthour.org. The show notes page for this month's episode will contain information on where you can buy Non-Believer Nation, The Rise of Secular Americans by Dave Niosi. You can also find his speaking schedule. So he's currently on tour through the fall. So definitely check out if he's going to be in your area. And you can also find links to subscribe to us both on iTunes and just via RSS in whatever RSS reader you use. And you can find us, you can like us on Facebook.
Yeah. And if you've got any comments or questions, you can feel free to post them on our Facebook page.
All right, Todd. Well, hey, thanks for another great show.
Yeah. Thanks, Jess. Have a good one.
Listeners, thanks for listening to The Humanist Hour, and we'll see you next month.